Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Welcome in Rose City to a special edition of the Soccer Made in Portland podcast. I'm Ryan Clark. Today we're joined by a special guest on the pod, Meg Linehan from The Athletic. You can read her work at The Athletic covering all manner of soccer stories over the last several years, a few of them involving our teams here in the great Northwest. Wanted to get Meg's perspective for what has been an interesting few days in terms of PTFC. We just released the Oregonian did an investigative story involving the workplace culture at PTFC, multiple accusations within the story, including many that involve president of business Mike Golub. He's accused of hostility toward female employees, inappropriate touching, including shoulder rubs, general horseplay behavior in the office that people perceived as inappropriate, yelling and screaming in meetings, and leadership style that people had issue with that had previously worked for him. We spoke to 10 former employees about this issue, many of which spoke anonymously for fear of retribution from the club. And one of those employees spoke about her issues with pumping breast milk in the office at PTFC, wherein she said that she was put in a dusty, cramped electrical closet in order to pump on game days. On non-game days, she was able to use Merritt Paulson's suite that he likes to watch games from. Merritt has been accused of insensitivity with regard to that, particularly when it comes to his response to that. And the club denies any wrongdoing, but says that Mike Golub in particular is in sensitivity trainings right now as we speak to address some of the issues found within a internal report from DLA Piper, a law firm that that the Timbers and Thorns organization has gotten to conduct the investigation into their workplace. They found three total issues. One of them was with Mike Golub and his leadership style, and they won't get into detail about that, but a lot of the trainings that Mike Golub is in line up with what we have reported at the Oregonian. So diving right into it with Meg, who will be able to provide additional perspective on this. Meg, what was your reaction to reading this story, and what do you think it says about the club culture broadly?
I mean, I think my initial reaction when I was reading it, obviously there are a lot of voices in the story. And I think reporting like this is really important because obviously not every story is going to be like a Paul Riley-esque level story, right? Like where it's so clearly past the boundaries. I think that the next part of what we have maybe been grappling here in the soccer community is where those boundaries are and where they can get crossed. And the difference between what it is to just be kind of like questionable in your role and what like actively is a behavior that people are going to view as, you know, inappropriate, harmful, making them uncomfortable, all that kind of stuff. And so I think now this is a much harder line to define, but I think what you can see from talking to 10 plus people, right, is that there is this sense of the boundaries here are not quite in alignment with where they should be. And one of the really big things that I think we need to talk about in this community is sports. When we're in this world, like, some of the behavior gets excused because of, oh, it's sports, right? And not just like, oh, it's men's sports, because it happens in women's sports too, but like that this fast-paced environment is going to excuse any number of behaviors because that's what we're all used to or should consider normal. And so I think that normalization part, like, that's really the thing that's very concerning to me, is that when things become normal, it then enables worse behavior. And so we're seeing kind of at the foundation, at the top of the front office, that there were behaviors that multiple people found really questionable and really bad. And then you see other stories coming out of Portland, right? And it, you do kind of get the sense of, okay, well, it's not 2 + 2 = 5, right? It's 1 + 1 + 1. And you get a conclusion, right? And that may or may not be accurate from the outside, but Portland now is really in this space where they have a lot of work to do to rebuild trust. And I think, like, that's really a big thing that we're going to have to talk about, is how the Portland organization rebuilds trust with their own fans when these stories keep emerging.
Right. And you know, there have been so many of those fans who have called for accountability. That's been then the main word that you hear from fans, you hear from players in the NWSL and other voices out there. Do you think that those voices, those people who have spoken out, will be satisfied by sensitivity trainings, by some trainings which, in Mike Golub's own admission, are self-guided? And do you think that those type of statements and the type of responses that Mike Golub and Merritt Paulson as well had in that story, do you think that's going to be enough for those people?
I mean, I think just based on the past year, right, that the Portland front office has had, you really, I think it's going to be really hard for Portland to dig themselves out of the hole, that I think, like, in terms of that trust. But I think the fundamental thing that is the biggest struggle too is, and I think it's completely understandable from a human level, but, you know, reading some of these quotes, right, there was kind of maybe a little bit of a disconnect, because sometimes, like, oh, I'm a tactile guy, but also I didn't have any of these behaviors, right, from Mike Golub, where a lot of them did not necessarily make a logical sense with each other. But there is this kind of initial response of defensiveness. And I think that we've seen that over the past year, right? And I think we've seen it from on-field behavior with Merritt Paulson too, interacting with fans, of there is a little bit of anger and resentment, right? Of look at what I've done for you, or look at the team, right? And this is the price we have to pay for being a good soccer team, which is just kind of not really connected to any of what people are talking about. But I think the big question now for Portland, and especially the people at the top, are if defensiveness is kind of that initial reaction, then, like, what is the next step in this reaction? And, like, self-guided trainings are great and everything, but does that really equal up to the work that probably needs to get done to rebuild trust? I don't think so. And I think my big question too, coming from primarily the NWSL world, is there has been a lot of institutional power in Portland for the NWSL, right? Merritt Paulson has had a huge influence on the league in both good and maybe challenging ways, right? But Mike Golub has been super involved in a lot of the business side of the NWSL. He was just on the search for a new commissioner, which resulted in the hire of Jessica Berman. So you have people who are the subject of stories where former, you know, employees are talking about their behavior, and then knowing that they are shaping an entire league. Like, that's also, I think, a piece that we need to talk about, of are these voices that we should be putting in positions of power within the NWSL when a lot of this is still kind of unresolved, and that accountability piece, I think, is still a big question mark for a lot of people.
Right. And the NWSL issued a statement. The MLS has not issued a statement with regard to the alleged behaviors with Mike Golub and Merritt Paulson. But NWSL released a statement that in part says there's nothing more important than the culture of the league, that employees deserve a respectful professional workplace, and that they are aware of the internal investigation conducted by DLA Piper for the PTFC. And they are supportive of the changes that are implemented in terms of those findings, those changes being the trainings. But we have seen across NWSL, there have been different levels of accountability with regard to workplace behavior in particular. And those have been a result of myriad investigations. I'm wondering how those two things square with one another, where the league essentially comes out in support of the steps that Portland is taking and does not go much further than that, while there has also been differing levels of accountability for other instances similar to this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good question. And also, I think there's kind of the fundamental question of, we got told Portland was doing this internal investigation right after the Athletic story on former head coach Paul Riley and the events of 2015. And then now it's kind of getting called a culture review. So I do think that we have both like logistical questions there, but also I think it is really tough because also reporting this stuff is really, really hard, right? And especially I think the tail end of it is really hard because in the NWSL, right, there are still a lot of active and open investigations, including the main one between the NWSL and the NWSL Players Association, into culture across the league and potentially, you know, concerning behaviors there. And we're now about like a month and a half out from the year anniversary of the report. And we don't really still have a sense of timing on that front. We still have a Sally Yates investigation hanging out for US soccer. Again, not a lot of timing, though we did get this kind of like interesting statement from Sally Yates being like, I sure do wish people would cooperate with me. Right. So trying to get details out of an organization, which is, I think in many ways, it's a good thing that they are designed to protect their employees, right? Because this is not like a legal proceeding or anything. Like, it is a private employer discussing matters with their own employee, but like trying to report this stuff is really, really hard. So the NWSL does have to walk this really fine line of, okay, we know Portland has done certain things. They have reported what they need to us. We have to kind of have a stance on this because of everything that's happened. But also we still have all of these things hanging out. And there's not really, I think, an answer that's going to satisfy everyone, if not anyone, right? Like, the team is not going to probably want the NWSL to make a statement. The fans are looking for a lot more. The supporters are looking for a lot more. And how do you navigate that? It's a really tough question. And really, I think the big piece here is that we're just waiting on the results of these other investigations. And until that happens, we still do not really know the extent of what's been happening. We do have this kind of basics of the facts of what happened in Portland, but we don't necessarily know internal processes. And we also don't know how much we're going to get out of any of that. So really the reporting part of this is very hard. And I think reminding people of that is definitely helpful, just in terms of, it's going to be really hard to get to a resolution where everybody actually feels satisfied, I think.
Right. There are so many emotions weaved into this as well. People who are survivors, people who have experienced abuse like this in their own lives, who want a level of accountability in this public setting that they might not have received individually. I'm curious on another note about your thoughts on the through line from the Paul Riley story and that scandal in 2015 to the issues involving former Portland Timbers player Andy Polo to now these workplace issues that have been alleged in the investigation that we underwent and then the internal investigation that the Timbers and Thorns organization did themselves. How do you compartmentalize that? How do you see that through line as far as being a potential trend?
I mean, all of these stories do tend to revolve around the same leadership group at the team, right? The same names have been there the whole time. So I think that there are valid questions to be asked of Merritt Paulson as an owner, of Gavin Wilkinson as the general manager, of Mike Golub as, you know, the leader of the business side of the team. And I think really what gets reinforced by a story at the Oregonian with the other two is that it's maybe not just the big stuff, right? That there are also questions about the smaller day-to-day things, right? And what I spoke to before about normalization of behaviors, right? So more and more things become permissible, or things are, you know, I think that Portland, when I was reporting the Paul Riley story, right, a lot of it took place outside of Portland and was not reported in a way where Portland would have had the information to take appropriate action. And do I think if, and I'm not blaming the player in question here for not reporting, it was not the right time for her, 100% understand that, but there, that does limit the information that Portland is working with. I still think that there is enough there in terms of Mana Shim's report about what happened in 2015 that suggests that they probably could have done more, right? There is that balance of, in theory, this is a complaint situation between two of your own employees, and how do you balance that? But I think the question is what we have seen from Paul Riley thing, where he gets his contract isn't renewed, right? They send him out the door. He gets immediately rehired. The Andy Polo stuff, again, you know, there have been investigations around that as well, but I think it speaks to what the team views as like a permissible behavior from leadership in terms of how they're going to approach really questionable situations. And so I think there is a through line, right, that we have now seen, and obviously the connections between the NWSL story, the Andy Polo story, were really, really easy for people to make. But now having the front office piece where the smaller behaviors are also being called into question by their own employees, again, it's gonna make that hole that they need to dig out of in terms of public perception, in terms of like that, the honestly, the real work that they really do have to do in the front office to figure out how do we build a better organization where people feel safe and respected. It's a much harder job now. And hiding behind performance on the field is just, it's not a good solution for anyone.
Do you think Portland could serve as kind of a poster child for this level of institutional change that the NWSL players and other activists out there are seeking, just given the fact that, you know, irrespective of everything that has happened, the Portland Thorns are one of the most successful franchises in NWSL history, one of the most recognizable women's sports brands in the world, and they have a bunch of amazing superstar personalities on their team, people like Christine Sinclair and Sophia Smith, and the Timbers, with respect to MLS, have been one of the most successful franchises since they entered the league. If there is a greater level of accountability in the eyes of fans and of people who are seeking it, what could you envision as far as Portland being that poster child for something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think if the work gets done, right, the main thing standing between them being able to hold themselves as a real true example of, look, we did the work, we can prove it, we can live these values day in, day out. If another situation arises, we can prove to you that it's been handled correctly. The only thing standing between Portland, beyond like all the actual work that needs to happen, but what we're seeing now is, look at the Andy Polo thing, right? The investigation gets released, and there is this inherent sense from the public that they don't trust the results of it. So how do you overcome that? And I think that's a really, really hard question, because also it immediately gets kind of followed up by this Oregonian story, right? Which only, I think, then reaffirms what everybody believes about Portland. So how do you prove that not just you're doing the work, but like the processes are better, the systems are better? If something happens in the future, it's going to actually resolve in a way that people would be satisfied by? And I don't have a great answer for that. But what I think is really interesting is that, you know, what we have seen, especially in the NWSL, in terms of the NWSL Players Association, in terms of their leadership, right? Players are not afraid to say, like, okay, you know, we have a list of demands. We want to see X, Y, Z. And they're going to have much greater visibility to what's actually happening inside the organization than any of us, right? Like, we can absolutely talk to sources and all of that kind of stuff. But like, what they're experiencing day in, day out, do they feel valued? Do they feel like they're actually a part of this organization that is respected? That's a call on them, right? And I think we need to see that kind of, like, that's going to be, I think, a key part to Portland moving forward as an organization, is that if we see players and staff kind of externally vouching, right? And not just necessarily carrying water, but saying like, hey, there are still improvements that need to be made, but we have seen improvements in these areas, right? And that's also, I think, how change gets accomplished, is that you do have forces from the outside calling for change, but you also have players and staff who are trying to build better things within. But again, do you believe the result of an investigation when it comes out? That's a huge stumbling block. And the fact that, you know, all of these stories eventually do come back to Merritt Paulson as owner and what has happened under his ownership of the team. Obviously, his personality is very big, right? Like, I'm not trying to personally disparage him, but like, he has a very strong sense of what he thinks is right or wrong, right? And a very certain, like, strong way of talking. And it does alienate people. And again, there is that defensiveness. But do I think fundamentally, he has shown that, like, he believes in the work of soccer? Sure, right? But there's that sense, like, and this is what we've seen across the leagues, both leagues really, is that you can't use that as an excuse for all of this other stuff, right? The Deloitte Hansen story in Utah, all of this, right? And I'm not trying to compare them one to one and say one is worse than the other, but it's just, I think the team does need to take a step back and say, okay, how do we start to work at repairing this relationship so that way the trust is rebuilt? And that's such a large project and is not going to happen overnight by any stretch of the imagination.
Meg Linehan with The Athletic, thank you very much for taking the time today. We'll be right back here on Soccer Made in Portland after a quick break.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome back to Soccer Made in Portland. Thanks again to Meg Linehan for taking the time to speak with us. Always good to have a national perspective on these local issues that are facing the two clubs that the folks listening to this podcast follow so closely. Got Chris Reifer here to talk some soccer, but first, Chris, anything additional you wanted to add before we get into that?
Hello, and I guess welcome to me to this podcast that's been going for a little while. So just as a reminder to folks, I think we talked about this sort of at the jump of the rise of this podcast from the ashes, that I just have some professional entwinements that keep me from talking about things like that publicly. And so that's why you got to have that lovely conversation with Meg, which in my opinion, just assessing the relative merits of me versus Meg, that is an enormous upgrade for this podcast to have Meg on to talk about something like that rather than me. She is much smarter than I am. And so I hope you all enjoyed that. I'm here to talk primarily about a drive to deep left field by Castellanos. So with that, go for it, Ryan. What are we going to talk about?
And there's a drive to deep left field. So we'll get started with the thorns here as far as the soccer discussion possession. Thorns got a 2-1 win on the road at the Washington Spirit on August 10th. Really impressive victory. Really one of the season defining moments, I think, for this Thorns team to showcase its mettle, its willingness to be able to come back in a game like that. Down 1-0, missing Sophia Smith due to a minor injury. And they got on their horse, and Christine Sinclair led them over the finish line. And Morgan Weaver, with a tremendous finish of her own, she's really come into her own as a goal scorer for this team. And they get the 2-1 win on the road against a Washington team that, for all people's accounts, has underperformed this year given its talent. I mean, you look up top with players like Trinity Rodman up there. I mean, she was a powerhouse, and they have struggled this year. And games like this are one of the examples of why, you know, they haven't been able to necessarily finish them off. But I think it says a lot more about the Thorns and the culture that they're building that they were able to pull off this victory.
Yeah, I think it's funny. The Spirit are a funny team because they have what I think still one win on the year, which, you know, in the vein of my take from last week that the weather is too hot, that is not good. One win to you know, build on my reputation for stating the obvious. But they have a ton of draws, and when you watch them just on the field, they don't have the eye test of a team that is a sort of wooden spoon, you know, contender kind of team. They look like a pretty solid team, of course, as their accomplishments of last year indicate. And so I think this was a more difficult game for the Thorns than they perhaps, you know, would have got credit for. And the Spirit are still a difficult team to beat. This game sort of gave me similar feelings as the draw in Chicago did earlier this year, when the Thorns were in a little bit of a rough patch, and they really just kind of got into a heavyweight boxing match with the Red Stars. The Spirit, of course, haven't been as good as the Red Stars. But the Thorns had some pretty significant adversity thrown their way immediately before kickoff when Sophia Smith came out of warmups, it sounds like, with some degree of tightness, discomfort. What was the word used?
Yeah, it was a tightness that she experienced. They didn't say what muscle or like what extremity she was dealing with tightness, but there was a tightness to be had. And you know, given how many games the Thorns have this month, they can, even though she's a superstar, even though she makes them go, they can afford to be a little more conservative with that. So I totally understood that.
And I think they kind of have to. But this was nonetheless an important game because they're in a shield race. And as I was watching sort of over the course of the game, it felt like one of those games. I thought the Thorns played pretty darn well. Throughout most of the game, I thought they created a ton of chances that almost to a darkly comedic extent just didn't come off. But they were getting into really good spots. They just weren't hitting the final balls. They just weren't finishing. And they had a ton of near misses. And I initially was kind of like, oh, is this just going to be one of those games where they play well, they create a ton of chances, nothing comes off, and then they... You know, and then my fears came true. They did give up kind of a weird goal. Bella Bixby, who to that point had a tremendous game, continuing a tremendous season, had a weird one, I think is probably a fair way to characterize it. I've watched it multiple times. I don't really know what to make of it. And I just had this sinking feeling where it was like, oh, they've put in so much good work over the course of more than an hour, and that's going to be it? Like, that's what's going to do it?
Yeah, in a game where the goalkeepers were featured, where they were both so incredibly good, had that been the difference? Had that been, you know, her accidentally walking backwards across the line with the ball because of her momentum? I mean, that being the difference would have been insane. But, you know, thankfully the soccer gods had other plans.
Yeah, and thankfully the Thorns had other plans, because I am not going to ascribe to divinity what can be explained by humanity. In this instance, I think it was the humans on the thorns who dug deep to get this result. It had been there throughout the whole game, and they just sort of found a way. And I think you very correctly pointed to the leadership of a Christine Sinclair. The quality on the field with Morgan Weaver now really sort of having a strong stretch of her season. That is an exciting result. And that's the kind of result, frankly, that if this is a Shield winning campaign, you're going to look back on at the end of the season and say those 3 points were huge. And finding a way to gut those out, to scratch and claw that result. It's a weird thing to say in a game against one of the, you know, teams on the bottom of the table. But that's just the kind of result that you need if you're going to win the Shield. And so I am back after a week of being not concerned, because I wasn't concerned after the draw against the Courage, but disappointed to see those points go away and kind of thinking, oh, they might really rue that. This is the opposite side of that coin. This is a result that very easily, and I think frankly for most teams, would have slipped between their fingers, whether they'd drawn or lost that game. I think the overwhelming majority of teams draw or lose that game. I think these thorns, they got guts. They got real guts. And they got a lot of talent, and they're well organized, and they're well trained. And they got a lot of guts. And I think that's a pretty potent combination, which is why, lo and behold, they're top of the league.
Exactly. And top of the league right now at 28 points, 7 wins, 7 draws, and only 1 loss. That is a league low for losses, just 1. Goal differential of plus 21, which is way better than any of the other teams. the next best is Houston with a plus 9. So...
Houston's really having
and Houston's having a moment. They're doing really well. That's a team that has, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, handed the Thorns their lone loss of the season.
And then the Thorns went down and pasted them in.
That's
in
right.
Houston. What was that? 4-0 or 4-1? Yeah,
something like that. It was quite the demolishing in revenge. But there's a 3-way tie now for 2nd in NWSL: Houston, San Diego, and Kansas City. OL Reign are just a point back of that group in 5th. Chicago Red Stars just a point back of OL Reign in 6th. It's tightly wound there, and the Thorns have a 3-point advantage on the field, essentially. And despite their dominance, despite how great they've been, these last few games are still going to have quite a bit of pressure because they, in seeking a Shield, they are also seeking the opportunity to have home field advantage throughout the playoffs. Even if they aren't able to get the Shield, even if by some miracle Houston continues its run and surpasses them, or San Diego gets back into form and surpasses them, Portland wants to host the playoff games that it plays. There is no team, with the exception of Angel City, who's not in the playoff picture right now. There's no team who has a better home field advantage, and they want that. They want to carry their journey to the NWSL championship through Portland, and eventually travel to DC at a site to be determined later to play for the NWSL title.
A site to be determined later. yes.
Here's hoping it's not where they played last week, by the way.
Yeah, no kidding.
In Northern Virginia.
So here is my hot take that's sort of just a wild offshoot from your discussion there. The NWSL Shield should be a really big deal. It should be at least a co-equal trophy with the Cup, right? I think we need to be treating it that way. I mean, in MLS, you have the weirdness of having a really imbalanced schedule, making the Supporters Shield in MLS kind of a weird deal, right? Because it's not a level playing field, yada, yada, yada. You don't have that issue in NWSL. It is much more balanced, and it, by the way, should stay much more balanced, just in case anybody at the league office listens to this, your podcast. That's my opinion, and you should agree with it. But
write that on Chris Reifer's tombstone, by the way.
That is my opinion, and you should agree with it. But we, the Shield is a you know, and to invoke the current president, it's a BFD. Not going to spell that out, by the way. Family show.
Always been a family show. Always will be.
That's right. Gather around. But it's a BFD. And so, you know, I say this not because I chafe against when people are like, and they want home field advantage for the playoffs, but like the Shield is a reward in and of itself. And a Shield, and I think the Thorns probably have their 2021 season undervalued as a result of this. But the Shield is like a capstone accomplishment for any season in its own right. I think that's why, you know, in my view, frankly, the home field advantage through, in air quotes translate horribly to a podcast format, but I'm nonetheless verbalizing air quotes, home field advantage throughout, quote unquote, the playoffs, is important. But it's a side perk when it comes to what is the much bigger deal, which is winning the Shield.
Right. And this league is so balanced and so, you know, tough to
exactly.
win.
Exactly. I think it's a murderer's row. And so like getting through the murderer's row of a whole bunch of really good teams, frankly, I mean, I think you can rattle off 5 or 6 teams this year that look like they could win the championship. Right, that look like they could win the playoffs. That look dangerous.
Yeah, I mean fifth place OL Reign easily could be there at the end.
Very easily. We've talked about how it's looked to us like the Thorns and the Reign are the two best teams in the league, and yet they're 1-5. Which speaks to the depth of the league. And when you work your way through that schedule, when you work your way through that table, and you come out on top. Whichever team that is, I'm not saying that's going to be the Thorns because they still have a lot of work to do, including some that we're going to talk about in just a second. That's a BFD. And I think it needs to be sort of recognized in its own right as such. Should be a bigger banner than the MLS is back.
True. Yes, it should definitely be bigger than that. That banner should be like NYCFC size, probably. Maybe a little bigger because that's like a 11x17 poster, but
they printed it in landscape.
Yeah, they did. They
it's 8.5x11. They printed it
at Kinko's. Like they just went to, they were like, hey, we got to put up this banner, and then they got it done at Kinko's and just brought it.
That sounded more Boston to me than New York.
I was thinking some kind of, you know, street tough guy from Yonkers or something.
It's unfortunate you didn't run this by Meg, who actually is really well situated to opine on the differences between New York and New England accents. So that's a miss on your part. So way to blow that interview.
Well, yeah, clearly. I mean, there were a few more important things I think that we discussed than the differences between accents, but you know, we'll let the listeners decide whether or not that's true. Transitioning here, however, to what's coming up for the Thorns tonight. This is being recorded Wednesday morning. Tonight, they play CF Monterrey from Mexico in the opener of the ICC, the women's ICC, here at Providence Park. 8:40 p.m. kickoff. Boy, am I going to be at that stadium for a long time tonight, but that's my own problem. the other two teams in the tournament are Olympic Lyonnais and Chelsea FC women, who will be playing each other at 6 p.m., a rational time to play a soccer match, although it'll be a good bit hotter at that time tonight.
Yeah, that's good.
Weather made in Portland.
Not optimal.
Yeah. 95 degrees.
Too hot.
Just nasty hot. Down on the turf with the sun hitting them for a portion of that.
Yeah, I feel bad.
That sucks. So they'll play at 6. The winner of that game will play the winner of the Thorns in Monterrey, which one would expect would be the Thorns, but Monterrey, obviously one of the toughest teams down in Mexico, and brings a lot of talent into this tournament and wants to prove itself. The Thorns plan to rotate their lineup heavily throughout this tournament. Rian Wilkinson told me as much, only because they got 6 games this month. They've played 2 of them. two of them are in this tournament. That would be today, Wednesday, and then the championship and or third place match on Saturday.
And when they're saying they play six games this month, and it's the 17th, and they've only played two.
That's four, in a short stretch here. Yeah.
That is a harbinger of rough seas ahead.
Yes. And so the games that they, frankly, care more about are the two NWSL ones that they'll have to play August 24th against the North Carolina Courage on the road in North Carolina. And then 3 days later,
long ways away.
3 days later, they return home to face the San Diego Wave, who are right there with them in the Shield race. And that's going to be a tough turnaround for a team that already has a whole bunch of games to play here.
Let's talk about the ICC, but I do want to just put a pin in. I want to come back and have a little geography made in Portland segment later on. But let's start with the ICC with Monterrey, and then the Monterrey game, and then looking forward to the final. I mean, I wasn't surprised to hear Wilkinson say that she feels like she's got to rotate the team pretty heavily during this tournament. I think their priorities are in exactly the right place. I mean, the ICC on the women's side to me means more than it does on the men's side, just because, frankly, there's a little bit more international intrigue as between the leagues. We have fewer opportunities to see intercontinental play on the women's side. By the way, there needs to be a Club World Cup on the women's side, just in case anybody at FIFA listens to this podcast. That is my opinion, and you should agree with it.
Yeah, this fills that void very, not enough, you know?
But very clumsily, it fills the void. I mean, NWSL teams are in season, and you know, I mean, you have teams like the Thorns that have to make hard and unfortunate choices about who they're going to play and that kind of stuff. You've got teams coming over from Europe very clearly in preseason, kind of doing that kind of stuff. You know, so I think that's that it's a very clumsy way to sort of fill that role, and it's really unfortunate. But I do think that they have to rotate sort of through this period, and I think they probably have to rotate pretty heavily through this period, which isn't to say that they can't win. We've seen a lot of this depth. I mean, a lot of this depth has gotten NWSL time over the course of this year as a result of international absences and the like, and they did pretty dang well. There are going to be a lot of players who we're going to recognize, who have gotten important NWSL moments that are going to be playing in this tournament. And so I think there's still something to watch, but their priorities are in exactly the right place. They have to prioritize NWSL given how tight the Shield race is, what the stakes are, in the season. And I think that's how it goes. That doesn't mean that Sophia Smith isn't going to play a minute in the ICC. I think it probably depends on how that tightness is resolved, the unspecified tightness. It's going to depend on how that's resolved and the like. And I'm sure, you know, those players are going to see the field some, but it shouldn't be a whole lot. And it sounds like they're approaching it the right way. So other than it being too hot, I think there's something to watch. But I wish there was a more formalized, better way to do this, because I do think there's a space for it. I'm very much of the opinion that people overvalue or not overvalue, because they undervalue dramatically women's soccer in Europe. I think they to some extent overrate some of the European teams and some of the European leagues vis-a-vis NWSL. And at very minimum, I'd like to see those games. I would like to see those games with stakes, with teams in form, and with teams able to take the time from their league schedules to make it happen. Because I think those would be really interesting, really good games. And if we see, as we see sort of the game in Europe starting to really build momentum in terms of broader attention to the women's game, I think there would be a lot of folks who would be interested in that. I just think the ICC is an imperfect way to do that. And I think it makes it so that it sort of is a year by year case as to how seriously the Thorns are going to be able to take it. And I think this is just a year that, you know, they sort of have to have, they got bigger fish to fry.
Right. And I think that that's the reason why the Spirit declined participating in the first place. You know, I don't think Portland really had a choice given that A, they're the hosts, and B, they won it last year. And there's really few better places to host a tournament like this than Portland, Soccer City, USA. A ton of people will come out that are just fans of the sport generally. They might not even be hardcore Thorns fans.
The Spirit going to like host it on the White House South Lawn or something?
Yeah, I don't know. They don't.
I mean, that'd be cool.
They don't ever play in the same place. Cool. That actually would be
pretty cool. They'll just play like on one of the rec fields on the mall that everybody plays rec sports.
I love the National Mall. Having recently visited D.C., it's really cool. Love
the space. Do you love the mall or do you love the things around the mall?
I think more the things, actually. Yeah.
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 I mean, I think it's cool when the mall does have all of those rec sports going on. I think that's genuinely a cool thing because you can sort of like go for a walk and it's just softball game after you know, soccer game after, you know, I mean, and it's just like there are a bunch of folks out sort of enjoying the space. I really enjoy all the things around the mall. I don't love the mall itself. Kind of perspective.
Yeah, I get that. But hopefully, you know, if they ever do host a soccer match there, they make it a cool experience. That would be pretty sweet, actually.
What's your favorite place in D.C.?
There's an Indian restaurant I went to with my brother when I visited. That was excellent. The name of it is escaping me. I will pull up the name.
Indian food is phenomenal. So I don't have a hard time.
Hard to go wrong, you know, from fine dining Indian food to the cheap eats that you could find at a food truck, pretty much anywhere, particularly in my hometown of Beaverton, Oregon, which has
I guess I was more thinking of like places of national significance than just like Ryan's.
Oh no, I don't care.
But I respect that shout. Yeah, to be honest.
Like I saw the Capitol, whatever, man. Like it's fine.
I'm a big fan of the FDR Memorial, although I think they did an amazing job with the MLK Memorial. I think the MLK Memorial is really cool and really powerful.
Yeah, that was very cool.
And so it has risen up toward the top. But I think the FDR Memorial is one of my favorite places in DC. It's really pretty, really serene. When you got the cherry blossoms going on, it is popping.
The Indian restaurant's name is Rasika in Rasika. DC. It's in a pretty bougie area of DC, but my God. What an excellent establishment.
Go check out Rasika and then go take a walk between the MLK and FDR memorials. You'll have a nice day in DC. This was a really, really hard tangent that we just went on. That we just went on there based on my joke that they were going to play a Spirit-hosted ICC game on one of the rec fields on the Capitol Mall. sorry, everybody. Although maybe if somebody's like going to DC, maybe business dude is like going to DC next week and he's like, man, this podcast gives me everything. It gives me DC tips and helps me rest up for my trip.
Yeah, maybe you can get some sleep on the plane.
That's right. It's one stop shop for business dude. Oh, but yeah, I'm both looking forward to the ICC. I guess I'll put it this way. I'm both looking forward to the ICC and also like feeling slightly inconvenienced by it.
Yeah, I think the Thorns probably internally feel the same way. Rian Wilkinson gave a nice, political answer as far as, you know, the tournament, and
she's really good at that.
Yeah, she's great with the press. She knows how to word stuff. And she talked about it.
And when she doesn't want to say something, she is really good at
not
saying something without saying anything.
Yeah, exactly. And with this tournament, she's like, yeah, you know, we want to put a team out there that wants to win, but you know, the reality is yada yada, like with the fact that they, have so many games this month. So she knows how to play that. If you got the real from it, it would be, please get this over with. This is a great tournament, awesome showcase for women's soccer, but get it over with. We have so many games and they matter a lot in NWSL for the standings. Can we please just get to those? The inconvenience aspect, I'm sure, is something that they feel on some level, but that's part of the deal and part of the sacrifice as the game continues to grow and as the Thorns continue to become one of the most prominent women's sports brands in the world. And that's exciting in a lot of ways.
And a lot of that attitude, though, is just driven by, and this is my segue into geography made in Portland, is driven by what the Thorns have next, which, as you mentioned, is an away game. What is a rescheduled game at North Carolina, which was rescheduled from when North Carolina went to the Challenge Cup final, that for reasons that I think are fairly criticized, occurred during the regular season. And so they had to reschedule the Thorns game to make way for that. So they stuck it in on this Wednesday in August in North Carolina. Cool. And then the Thorns then travel back to play against San Diego in Portland on Saturday. I mean, the way, you know, we've been at this long enough that I think most folks have sort of caught on to the pattern. But leagues generally try, if you have a midweek game, and especially if you have a midweek game in which there's travel, leagues generally try to do a Wednesday-Sunday turnaround rather than a Wednesday-Saturday turnaround to allow for an extra day for travel, recovery, training, etc. It matters. I mean, when you have only 2 days between, adding a third day, that is 50% more. Also, math made in Portland. Apparently, the dogs behind me really like that joke. Big math made in Portland fans. But you know, that really matters. And I'm a little bit baffled, and I genuinely can't figure out why. I like tried to triangulate the schedules and all of that to figure out why NWSL scheduled this for a Wednesday, Saturday turnaround rather than if they had to add this on a Wednesday, this game in North Carolina, why they didn't then bump the game against the Wave at least back to Sunday. Because, and this is where geography made in Portland comes in. When you really look at a map, when you really study a map, it really becomes apparent that Portland and Cary, North Carolina, are not close to each other, like at all.
Is that part of the hot take segment?
Yeah, that's the geography made in Portland lesson of the day. Is that Portland and North Carolina are far apart. And, you know, I mean, as a practical matter, because of the way travel is going to work out, the Thorns are basically going to have an important game in North Carolina, a travel day, 1 day of training, and then an important game against the Wave. And when you're NWSL, I mean, especially that game against the Wave, with, as you know, the Wave haven't gotten as much attention as perhaps Angel City FC on the national scene. But they've been a pretty splashy expansion team. This should be a game that NWSL should really be wanting to market.
Splashy,
yes.
or was it intentional? Or were you?
It's been a good run for me. I think I'm gonna have to retire from podcasting. Oh man, I'm out, everybody. That see you later.
Sucked.
Brutal. this is the kind of game that NWSL should really want to have eyeballs on. There are interesting players. You've got a head-to-head between what is turning into sort of a Maguire-Sosa deal in the Golden Boot race between Alex Morgan and Sophia Smith. You have two teams that are at the top of the table. You have big stars. You have sort of, I mean, you have even have a narrative of sort of like Alex Morgan and then like maybe the most Alex Morgan-like player we've seen come up in the U.S. system for a long time going head-to-head. The number of narratives you could spin out of this game for a broader audience are ridiculous.
And it's still on Paramount Plus.
And it's still on Paramount. I mean, at least it's not Twitch. But it's on Paramount Plus, and you're going to have one of these teams playing with, like, 1 day of training between it and their last game. Like, that's not how you set up your product to be, you know, well-delivered to the people who you want to attract. And this, as best I can tell, and I've asked a few people and I have not received an answer, as best I can tell, this is just an unforced error. This is just, they didn't put one and one together to get the schedule right. And a game that should be really exciting and really marketable and a really, really good soccer game is being you know, is I don't want to say tainted because that's too strong a word. It's still an honest game. It's still a fair game. But is not being presented in the best way possible. And if you're NWSL, that's pretty brutal. Because you need to start putting your best foot forward on these kinds of games. They shouldn't be on Twitch. They shouldn't be on Paramount Plus. They shouldn't have one team playing with a ridiculous turnaround with bad travel. They should be putting their best foot forward on these games, and they're not. And that stinks. It makes for a really challenging turnaround for the Thorns with two really important games, as all games are important for them now. And it makes it so that this feels like more of a, like, let's grind and gut through it kind of thing than this is where we're going to sort of make a statement kind of thing. And that stinks. There's my hot take, but it starts with geography, which is, I just want to remind people. And again, if anybody at the NWSL office is listening to this, this is my opinion and you should agree with it. Portland and North Carolina are not close together. So, you know, adjust accordingly.
Strong takes from Chris Reifer. You can expect nothing less on a week-to-week basis. We will transition, however, to our pals, the Portland Timbers, who had a bit of a rough one up north in their most recent match, a 3-1 loss to Toronto, just an Italian avalanche, if you will, where they brought the game back level, but then things got Italian and were not ideal for the Timbers. I think that you know, this was in many ways a long time coming for a team that had, yes, 10 unbeaten games, but the most recent of their unbeaten games were three draws, which two most recent of which were a little concerning, a little disappointing in spots.
Soft.
Yeah.
It was a soft 10-game unbeaten streak.
I would agree with that. I mean, I don't think that it was an indication of any sort of dominance or, you know, massive turnaround. I think that the first five or six games of that streak, you know, maybe you could make that argument like, oh, here they come. Here come the turnaround Timbers. We made that argument on this podcast several weeks ago. And then things have just kind of middled out since then. And the Timbers are in this weird spot where, you know, they're in the race for playoff positioning. They're right there. But things start to also have to go right for them in terms of the other games. And they have to get good results in a final several games of their schedule, which are very hard for the most part.
Tough.
Really, really tough finish to the season. You got Sporting Kansas City on Sunday, which you gotta win that one, like no doubter. Can't come out with anything less than 3 points against a team you slapped 7-0 earlier in the year.
7-2.
7-2. Right? Yes, I always forget that they scored.
I mean, it's easy to forget the two when there's the seven.
Yeah, so 7-2 slapped them earlier this year. Then you return home August 26th for a game against Seattle on national television, which has plenty of narratives to for us to discuss, which we will get into on future podcasts. On the road to Austin, a team that's been really, really good this year, tough place to play in Austin on August 31st. Then you're home Atlanta, home against Minnesota, at Columbus, home LAFC, at Real Salt Lake. The form the Timbers are in, they could lose pretty much every single one of those games after Sporting Kansas City.
They could certainly draw every single one of those
we
games.
We know they can draw. If nothing else, this Timbers team has proven that, boy, can they draw the heck out of teams in this league. 12 draws this season for this group.
Any place, any time. Any opponent they can draw.
It's insane.
Oh, they would have liked to have drawn Toronto FC. Yeah, I mean, I think I definitely harbor your share your concerns about the Timbers. I guess I'm sort of at the point where I could see the Timbers making the playoffs. I could see the Timbers not making the playoffs. they have not shown me anything over the last several weeks that makes me think that they are a team of note in the playoffs. They look right now, and who's to say, you know, maybe they'll change this. They've got an opportunity still to change this. But they look right now like their ceiling is a playoff also ran. And you know, that's not going on the resume. So it concerns me. I'm less sort of down about the TFC game, frankly, than I think some others are. I actually thought the Timbers in the TFC game overall played reasonably well. I think the first half, it wasn't much to look at, but it was exactly what the Timbers needed to do in that first half. It was clear that TFC was going to carry much of the opening stages of that game. The Timbers tried to find and kind of had some semi near misses, opportunities to hit TFC on the counter and to play in behind and to do that kind of stuff. But the Timbers didn't create much. That really was secondary though. I mean, a lot of that first half was about bottling up TFC, not allowing them to have a ton of clear chances. And by and large, they did that pretty well. TFC had a ton of shots. They had a ton of shots even on goal. But until TFC scored in, what was it, the 40th or 41st minute, those chances weren't great. You weren't seeing sort of the quality from TFC's DPs really come out and really sort of affect the game. And that was mission accomplished, because in a game like that, where you've got a team that has frankly just more talent, is at home, you've got to pick your spots. And with TFC, where they're at, they've got some questionable team fitness because they had so many guys coming in the transfer window. They're still getting things sorted out. They have a bunch of guys who are coming off of off seasons who are in, you know, the equivalent of early season form, whereas the Timbers are in mid to late season form. It was really reasonable for the Timbers to say, you know what? If we're going to have joy in this game, it's going to be in the second half. It's going to be around the hour and after that. And so we're going to try to frustrate TFC. We're going to try to make them work. And we're going to, you know, sort of pick our spots to get back after them. And until they conceded a goal that I think the Timbers probably felt a little bit let down by themselves with it at the end of the first half, I think they did that. And then for the first half hour of the second half, I think the wisdom of that general approach to the first half really showed itself. TFC was gappy. The Timbers started dictating the game, and they started creating chances, and they ended up getting the goal to equalize it.
Jose Carlos Van Rijken goal,
first MLS goal. That's.
I thought about us when I saw that goal happen. I was like, you know.
You mean you thought about me, lifelong Jose Carlos Van Rijken?
Yeah, it was more about you. It was more about like, like, God, I bet Chris is so happy right now for his dear friend and a person who he praises to no end.
JCVR seems like a perfectly nice person. I enjoy the internet, you know, representations of the buddy relationship between him, Felipe Mora, and Sebastian Blanco quite a bit. Seems like a great guy. I was happy for him as a person.
Yeah, serious broship
there. To get his first
love the broship.
Yeah. To get his first MLS goal. Nicely taken goal. Really nicely worked goal from the Timbers. And so, you know, I thought the wisdom of that approach to the game really, you know, sort of, I mean, that kind of justified, like, Gio's vision sort of showed through and it justified itself in that stretch. And frankly, given how gappy TFC was during that period and how it looked like their legs were falling off, I understand the Timbers' temptation after scoring that goal to start taking some risks to see if they could get a winner. Because, you know, in the 5 minutes or so where the game was tied 1-1, I was sort of sitting there being like, this really feels like it's in the balance. Like the Timbers could sort of, you know, apply the pressure to TFC and they just may not have the fitness, frankly, to match up. And the Timbers started taking some risks and then they got burned by just class. Just class. That's what it was. Toronto's DPs are better than the Timbers' DPs by country miles. By the distance between Portland and North Carolina. That is the distance between Toronto's DPs and Portland's DPs.
Insigne is so good.
That really showed.
I mean, credit to Bernardeschi, who played really well himself, but Insigne the whole game.
He
was the best player on the field by as you said, a country mile. Perhaps further. Perhaps the distance from Portland to Rome or Portland to Milan was he better than the rest of the guys on the field.
We'll cover that in a future episode of Geography Made in Portland, but let me tell you, that is a long ways. Boy, oh boy, we'll bust out the maps. We will read maps to people on a podcast, which is going to be super exciting. And that is a long ways. But yeah, I mean, and as the Timbers, as the gaps in the Timbers defense, as they were taking more risks, got a little bit bigger, that just created space for those guys to kill them. And they did. I think if the Timbers could do it over again, they probably would be a little bit more prudent at 1-1. But I understand what they were thinking. I understand what they were seeing in the game at that point. And they chose to play with fire, which I don't think was a completely irrational decision at that point in the game. And they got burned. I mean, they got the downside of that risk, which happens sometimes. But, you know, I think you could probably, even at this point, sort of justify taking the risk to try to get 3 points and you know, putting the potential for 1 point kind of on the betting table, even if they lost.
In your view, do you think that they knock out Nashville or LA or even RSL? Do they get in based on what we're seeing right now?
I go back and forth on this. Honestly, I feel like it's 50-50. I feel like it's between those three, Portland and Seattle, just because of where they are, I guess I put Portland, fourth of those five teams, because that is the order in which they're on the table in terms of their likelihood to make the playoffs.
Oh, hot
but
take,
look, I mean,
yeah, you're really going out on a limb there.
I'm all over it. Today in characterizing distances as long, in reading the order of teams in the table. I think as you look at all those teams, their playoff chances. I mean, this is me speaking out of my tuchus. There are people who do things like this mathematically, but I would guess all of those teams have between a 40% and 60% chance of making the playoffs. Maybe a little bit higher than that on the high end, but probably not a ton. And so, yeah, I think that's probably where they are. And I'd put the Timbers, you know, somewhere between 40% and 50% chance of making the playoffs. But you know, as we've discussed, to me, that's not a be all end all. Because if the Timbers make the playoffs and go get housed in a first round away game at a good like Austin team or something like that, I guess that makes very little difference to me in terms of how I assess the season as a whole, as if they miss the playoffs, you know, as the first or second team out, and go home. I you know.
Yeah,
so, I mean, for me, the challenge for the Timbers is to like show me that they're more than just the Washington Generals to somebody's Globetrotters in the first round, and they haven't shown.
No, and you know, I'm not sure they're built to make that type of run that they have in the past. I mean, they have a bunch of talented veteran players, but health is a question. Defensive consistency is a massive question. Who they're going to put at center back and whether their feet are made of cinder blocks or not is a question. Aljaž Ivačić is not a question. I think he's been one of the best goalkeepers in MLS this year. He is now leading Major League Soccer in saves, at least as of the end of the last match. But he's been great. Nias Gota has improved quite a bit. Seba Blanco, when he's healthy and playing, continues to be the fiery, hyper dangerous presence that he's been, but it's not the same player anymore. And
you want me to put you on the spot for a hot take? All right. Should the Timbers bring back Jimmy Chara next year?
No, I don't think so. I with what you're getting,
do you consider in that analysis the effect on Diego?
I think it would have an effect on Diego, but I think that Diego is still going to play for the Timbers for the rest of his career and try and, you know, play another couple of years. But I think that's a valid concern, right? I think that from a soccer standpoint, if he wasn't, you know, Diego's brother, you'd look at his production and say, hey, let's find somebody that is better to put there. And they probably will. But the question is, do you do that, move on from him, or do you relegate him to more of a substitute role and keep him around in order to appease a club legend? I think that would probably be a safer bet.
And continue to occupy a DP spot.
See, that's the tough thing.
That's
where you get into the question of is this worth the price of admission here? Because Diego Chara is still very much one of the most effective defensive midfielders in the league, period. Despite his age, he's an incredible athlete, great fitness, tough as hell, great personality and ambassador for the club. This is going to be one of the questions of the offseason. And if my hot take is they should move on from him, but they should also be aware of the, as we've talked about, mitigating risks that would ensue.
I think I think in many ways the TFC game sort of really shined a light on what has been an issue all along, in what the Timbers are getting out of their DPs. And I think Yaroslav Nizhegoda is in terms of what he's produced for the Timbers, exactly in the mid-range of what you would expect given the characteristics of his signing. But I think the characteristics of his signing are the problem. $3 million DP strikers, $3.5 million DP strikers are no longer a thing for MLS teams that want to compete. Those are deals that the Colorado Rapids make. Those are deals that the San Jose Earthquakes make. One or two teams out there will hit one. Adam Buxa came in for about that at New England, and they really hit on that one. But that's the outlier. More often than not, that's not a player who's going to be an impact player, and I don't think Nizhegoda has been. It's not to discredit him. I think he's done reasonably well. On balance, he's scored a good number of goals. He hasn't produced in a lot of the other areas, but is that a difference making DP? No. Jimmy Chara, I think, is a like solid MLS starter, but he doesn't. I equate him in many ways to like a Christian Roldan, who's a good player, and I think Jimmy Chara is a pretty good player. But if you've got one DP who's underperforming in Nizhegoda, and you've got another DP who I don't think is underperforming, Sebastian Blanco is sort of a high TAM, low DP kind of guy who occupies a DP spot right now because of cap considerations, but could in the future be a TAM guy. And I think he's producing like that. I think you're getting about what you would expect and hope for from Blanco. But also there are just the realities that he's not sort of the MVP level player that he was at this stage of his career. And when you have that context, you can't have a solid MLS starter as your other DP, your DP who you've spent the most money on. And they've had a lot of times this year, quite honestly, in which because of injuries and absences and all of that, where they have looked to Jimmy Chara and said, you kind of need to be the guy who's going to carry us through this game. And he has far more often than not failed to do that. And so, you know, it's harsh because I don't think he's a bad player. But I just think in terms of the way the roster is structured, he's really hard to continue carrying. But I fear that they will because of his last name and because of who his brother is and because of the respect, the deserved respect that the club has for Diego.
Yeah, I think between the two of them, between him and Nizhegoda, it's far more likely they move on from Yaro if it comes down to that.
They should move on from both, because that TFC game that shows,
if
they want to compete at that level, they need to go spend between $16 and $20 million on two DPs that are going to come in and crush at those two positions.
Yeah, and you know, I've heard some rumblings of the club having an interest in spending big this offseason. Previously, that had been discussed by Gavin Wilkinson publicly as looking at a number nine. But that we'll see. We'll see how this offseason is handled from a financial perspective, because I think that Merritt Paulson and Gavin Wilkinson are very aware of the fact that this team, as presently structured, is not really a contender right now, given the age of its stars, given injuries that it's faced, and just given where they're at these different positions. They, I think, have done an admirable job loading up young pieces for the future, but if they want to contend next year, that level of spending is going to have to be in the cards, and we'll see if it is.
I think there's a decent argument to make that if you look, sort of zoom out and look at the Timber season from a 10,000 foot level, there are definitely other issues. Don't get me wrong. I agree with you that the defense has been inconsistent and has not found a rhythm. At times it's been pretty solid. At times it's been pretty shambolical. But I think if you zoom out from a 10,000 foot level, there's a good argument to be made that the Timbers were just sort of hampered by a lack of consistent production from their DPs, and that the difference between the Timbers and you know, the more competitive teams is just that top end talent.
Right. And in a league now that is being dominated by an LAFC, which has just thrown buckets of money everywhere, all over the place, brought in aging superstars, retained its own superstars that it already had. You got to do something to catch up, because it's not the MLS of 2012, 13, 15 anymore. No. This is a new league.
Who's the Timbers' best player right now?
Eric Williamson. But health-wise, it's a question this year. Yeah, and I think agree. That a close second would be Seba Blanco, just given his importance to what they do.
Diego Chara,
yeah. You know, given his importance defensively. It's just...
You know who we're not talking about in this conversation? Jimmy Chara, Yaroslav.
That's true. And those are the DPs, two of them. For the club. So something to think about. And you know, you may come to a scenario where you have to pay an Eric Williamson more in order to hang on to him. You might come to a scenario where down the road, Juan Mosquera is killing it after a couple of years and you got to pay him more. So these are, David Ajala is another one that like high potential, high ceiling. You might have to pay him more in the future. So this is, this is the quandary for the club that they're going to have to deal with as the years progress and they transition from an aging former contender into whatever they're going to be morphed into next year and in the years to come. But that will wrap it up for us here on Soccer Made in Portland. Ryan Clark here for Chris Reifer. Thanking you for joining us on this wonderful, warm, very warm Wednesday here in the Rose City. Get out to the WICC tonight if you don't already have tickets. Should be an amazing showcase of the top talent in the world. That is not a paid advertisement. That's a personal opinion. And make sure to...
Should people agree with your
yes,
opinion?
Yes, they should. Darn it. Agree with my opinion. I said it, therefore you should agree with it. And if you agree with it, or if not, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your pods. Say something nice, say whatever you want. And follow us on Twitter at Soccer Maiden PDX to keep up with all the latest pods that we put out. And we'll see you next week.